From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, facing the biological deadline that comes with middle age, we talk with James Atlas about his new memoir, My Life in the Middle Ages. He devotes chapters to time, home, money, failure, shrinks, the body, books, God, 25th anniversary, and the death of his father. Atlas is the author of biographies of Saul Bellow and Delmore Schwartz and was the founding editor of the Penguin Live series. Also, we meet Reza Aslan. As a child, he fled Iran with his family after the revolution and relocated in Oklahoma. He's written a new book called No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. He describes it as an argument for reform. And Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by Mary Gaucher. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer James Atlas. After having written biographies of the novelist Saul Bellow and the poet Delmore Schwartz, after having edited the biographies in the Penguin Live series, then starting a new series of books, Eminent Lives, Atlas has written a memoir about being middle-aged. He writes, "The greatest challenge of middle age is to accept one's limitations. It's not easy." The table of contents will give you a sense of what he talks about in the book: time, home, money, failure, shrinks, the body, books, God, 25th anniversary, death. The book opens with something many people face in middle age, the death of parents. The first chapter begins with the dreaded phone call, "Dad's in the hospital." His parents had been living in an assisted living facility when his father was diagnosed with a brain abscess, which was followed by heart problems. James Atlas was 52, his father was 87. After a period of hospitalization, Atlas's father was moved to a floor devoted to nursing care at his assisted living facility. This reading takes place in his father's room just after he died. Atlas is talking with his father's nurse.
"She gave me the name of a local funeral home. I was uncomfortable making the call while the row of patients, residents, inmates, sat in their wheelchairs silently observing me, drooling, their heads lolling to the side, their arms crossed in their laps. I couldn't make this call in front of them. I told the nurse about my qualms, and she led me to a phone in her office. When I was done making the arrangements, I went back to his room. He lay there, no longer he, but a corpse now. The departure of my father's life from his body was at once a great mystery and the most ordinary thing in the world. I had never been in the presence of a dead body before. I marveled at the radical fact of absence, the finality of it all. Not a word, no directive, no sign would ever issue from him again. I lounged in a chair, my leg over the arm, at ease. Then my sister-in-law came in with my mother. She stood over him and tried to take it in. 'I'm not ready to let you go, Bunny,' she said, talking to him in the same intimate, bantering voice I'd been hearing all summer. 'We had a good time, didn't we, darling? We laughed and laughed and had a good time. But I didn't want you to go yet. I didn't want you to go.' She kissed his head and turned to me, a confused look on her face. 'How did I let him get away?' she said. She went over to the window and looked out at the green lawn, the green shrubs visible at eye level through the basement window. 'Dear, I know this sounds strange,' she said in a half whisper, 'but I feel like he's still breathing.' On the bureau was a can of Gillette shaving cream that I'd bought the day before at Walgreens. I was planning to give him a shave, but it was too late for that now. I would take it home and use it myself."
That's James Atlas reading from his new memoir, My Life in the Middle Ages. Your book is about getting older and about your own mortality, and of course it starts with the death of your father. Writers are usually very self-conscious people who are always standing back and observing everything, even standing back and observing themselves. When your father died, did you feel what you expected to feel or what you thought you ought to feel?
No, it was a very liberating experience, because I felt that his death, I know this sounds strange, but that it worked out right, that I spent a few months with him, that we said our goodbyes. It felt like a passage that had taken its course and been done right.
You say that for your father, one of the most important aspects of parenting was to make the child feel no obligation whatever to the parents, and that your father's parents had oppressed and crowded him, but he would set his children free whether they wanted to be free or not. What obligations did you feel to your parents as they got older and had more trouble taking care of themselves?
It's a very complicated thing, because one does feel this obligation, and it's part of one's own life. You have to take care of them. You have to be sure that they have enough money, that they're in the adequate place for themselves, that they're not alone, that they're not neglected. And yet at the same time, if I may say so, there's this resentment. It's as if you want to lead your own life and get on with it. And then I recall that they felt that way about their own parents. I had an argument with my mother the other day and made her burst into tears. And then she said to me a few days later, she said, I felt so bad because it reminded me of the way I used to yell at my own mother. So instead of getting angry at me, she felt guilty and recalled the entire experience of what she had gone through. And now I feel I'm sure it's the experience that my children will go through with me.
My guest is James Atlas, and he's written a new memoir, which is called My Life in the Middle Ages. Let's talk a little bit about how you're dealing with being in what you describe as late middle age or approaching late middle age. How does being in your 50s compare to how it looked to you when you were a young man?
Well, it's very strange. As I said to my son this morning when I explained that I really liked cross-country skiing, even though it was boring to him, I said, look, I'm 55. And when I said it, I thought, isn't that strange? And yet, there's a kind of elasticity now to middle age and late middle age. People say to me when they read my book, well, what's old age? And if they're 60, I said, well, you're in late middle age. And if they're 70, I say, well, you're in rather late middle age. And no one is old anymore. It's wonderful. We've banished old age. So don't worry about it.
But how does it feel to be in your 50s compared to how it looked to you when you were young?
It feels, in a way, like an act of completion. When you're young, I was so confused and so uncertain of my identity and my future. And now I feel a certain confidence that I never had before, a certain at-homeness, a certain comfort in the world. And even though I have much ahead of me, I hope, I've made my peace with certain things. And I find that very reassuring. On the one hand, you feel the imminent approach of mortality. On the other hand, you look back and can judge and assess what you've accomplished. And even if it's not quite what you aspire to accomplish, it's enough. And so there's this feeling of serenity that I certainly didn't have when I was young.
What are some of the things you've made your peace with?
Oh, I've made my peace with a lot of things. I've had and hope to continue to have a good writing career, but I didn't turn out to be a famous novelist, and that's okay. I'm lucky I got to make a living as a writer. And barring some surprise, I'm not going to be rich, and that's okay, except for my alarming credit card bills. And I am not going to grow anymore. I'm going to remain just under 5'6", and that's the end of that. So it's...
I have no words for encouragement on that one.
So I gather from what I know of you. But that's okay, too, right, Terry?
Right.
We're still okay.
You write a little bit about your body and how it's changing, and you say, I'm intermittently aware of my body, conscious that it's beginning to break down. Mom is conscious of her body all the time. Nothing will relieve her dizziness. The doctors have tried everything. I know what you mean when you say, I'm aware of my body. If, you know, any kind of you have a symptom, your body's kind of speaking to you, and you'd prefer it be quiet.
But yes, I really don't want to hear about it.
Right.
And Anna, my wife, and I made this vow never to talk about our ailments. I have friends who I have friends who are beginning to talk about their arthritis and their digestive issues. And I think this is just incredible. I'll never do this. And yet, sometimes when I feel mildly arthritic myself, I have to contain myself from talking about what seems to me an incredibly interesting issue, namely that I have arthritis. Which, well, I don't actually have. It's impending. I'm preparing for arthritis. I'm actually in great shape.
My guest is writer, editor, and publisher James Atlas. His new memoir is called My Life in the Middle Ages. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is writer, editor, and publisher James Atlas. He's written a new memoir about being middle-aged called My Life in the Middle Ages. He was the founding editor of Penguin Lives, a series of short biographies by well-known writers. Now he has his own publishing company, Atlas Books, and has started a new biographical series called Eminent Lives. You've published a lot of biographies. You've written two biographies, Delmore Schwartz and Saul Bellow. In 1996, you wrote a really interesting and pretty now famous piece on the growing popularity of the memoir as a form. And one of the questions you addressed in the piece is, why have so many memoirs focused on dysfunction? And you talked about how Joyce Carol Oates had come up with the word pathography to describe biographies that dwell on the sordid excess of their subjects. And you came up with the term autopathography about...
I did? Wasn't that yours?
Yeah, I assume
yes,
that was yours.
Yes, I'll claim it. Yeah,
it's a great term, and you came up with that for memoirs that dwell on the sordid excesses of oneself.
Right. Well, we could all write that book.
Yeah. So why do you think that, what does it say to you that so many memoirs over the years have focused on dysfunction?
I really hope mine doesn't, but there's a kind of prurience, I think, to it. There's a sense of... Well, perhaps there, but for the grace of God, if you're lucky, or there's the sense of association with the subject. You know, this biography, this autobiography by Augustine Burrow that's been on the bestseller list forever, Running with Scissors, I think that's an incredible book because it shows that you can survive. And when I talk about a survivor's tale, I'm being slightly ironic. But when you read some of these books, especially the good ones, you just marvel at the fact that these people did survive. You really want to know the truth about other people's lives. And I happen to feel that fiction doesn't do that now, that it's really the realm of nonfiction that gives you this information. It gives you this sense that of identification and the sense that other people suffer the way you do or suffer more than you do.
Do you think, too, that the whole sense of what is private and what shouldn't be discussed has changed? So things that you couldn't possibly address before, having to do with maybe sexual dysfunction or even things like lying, are kind of fair game for discussion in print. And so, like, they were pioneers who first kind of settled that territory, and then, like, everybody else moved in, too.
Yeah, they certainly did. There were the pioneers, and I hope I haven't followed them. I hope I have stayed on the Eastern Seaboard, because I didn't want to write a book that was that kind of revelation. I know this is virtually impossible, but I wanted to write the truth and at the same time maintain my privacy. My children read an earlier chapter of my book that I threw out because my daughter, who's very keen about literature, said, "Dad, this didn't really happen this way. You're making this up." And I decided that I didn't want to write it that way. I think you can write directly. I think you can write honestly. I think you can write the truth without this kind of excessive self-revelation. And it's hard to do. It's a very fine line. But I'm not really interested in parading my neuroses about. Even in the chapter of my book called Shrinks, which goes on and on, I don't really say what the problems are that I was talking about.
How did you decide where to draw the line about what you wanted to talk about in your memoir and the revelations that were really too personal to put in?
Oh, it's hard to talk about because I didn't put them in. But right. I think there are lots of private issues. I don't know. When I start writing and I don't feel comfortable and I don't feel at ease with the material, that's when I know I've gone over the line. And it's something that you learn after a while as a writer. You have to find your so-called comfort zone. And for some people, that's just saying it all. And they have a nothing to lose attitude about it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer, editor, publisher James Atlas. His new book is called My Life in the Middle Ages, and it's about growing middle-aged. You write a little bit about being in therapy in your memoir. And, you know, you had a lot of talk therapy, Freudian therapy. Without getting into what you were in therapy for, what your therapy sessions were like, I'm wondering if they were useful for you as a literary critic. Because so much of therapy is trying to get to the bottom of character, which is part of the work of a writer or a literary critic. Biographer.
Yeah, I think what happens in therapy is that you come up with what they call a narrative. You tell yourself a story about why you ended up the way you are and what were the formative influences and events that created the self you're now carrying around with you. And then it turns out to be just a story. And as I got older, I began to realize that this narrative was fiction in a way, useful fiction, but I learned how to tell a story, even if it wasn't the way things really were, and I became more and more interested in telling a story of the way things were, and that's how I ended up writing this book.
And what was the difference between the story that you learned to tell about yourself through therapy and the story that you tell in your memoir?
The first one wasn't true, and the second one is true. But it was very entertaining to make up these stories. No, actually, I'm rather quite militantly anti-therapy. And I think that we do create these stories, and they become fictions. They become myths, but we hide behind them.
So, you said you distrust therapy. Did you find, the narrative you came up with in therapy was too explanatory, too about cause and effect? Someone did this to me, therefore I did that. This happened to me in school, therefore I did this. Was that the problem?
Yeah, well, I feel that I now have changed my mind entirely, and I really feel that biology is destiny, and that when you look at anyone, including yourself, you can diagnose them. You can see whether they have depression or whether they have mood volatility. And these are just inherited traits. I really don't believe in the narrative any longer. I believe that we are the way we are because it's our biological fate. That's what I really feel. There's very little narrative. Maybe certain things happen, certain traumas that shaped you, but you really are who you are.
So this might be too personal, but do you take any psychopharmaceutical drugs? Because you believe in biology, the biology of mood. Do you tamper with the mood?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to give you my whole pharmacological history, but since it's in the book, obviously, like millions of others, I have dabbled in psychopharm and found it very helpful. And I don't think it's a mechanical issue. Take three of these and four of those and you'll be fine. But I do think that there are profound transformations that occur. I'm sure that you're familiar with Peter Kramer's book, Listening to Prozac. That book is really my Bible now because it tells you what I've just said. It is a book that's not deterministic entirely, but that really explains the profound transformations of character that occur when we take certain drugs.
One more thing. You are planning to write a history of biography as a form, and so you're reading a lot of ancient biographies as well as contemporary ones. And at the same time, you're working on a memoir that would be a follow-up to the memoir about middle age that you just published. So do you think that all these ancient biographies that you're reading will affect at all your second memoir?
I feel it's such an interesting experience to read these books and follow the development of the self from ancient biography through medieval lives of the saints and then to the gradual emergence of identity as we know it. And when I read Dr. Johnson's Lives of the Poets, or a book I was reading the other day by Daniel Defoe, a biography of a famous London criminal of the 18th century, I find that I now can understand myself as part of a continuum. It gives me a certain humility that my work simply reflects the voice of my time and the way we define ourselves, the way we define the self. So in a way, it sort of gets me off the hook, if you see what I mean, that I can write the way I want to write, and it will fall into this history of biography.
You mean that you don't have to worry about, you know, it being lasting or permanent, or, you know, that you could just write in your voice of the moment and feel that that will have a justifiable place in the world?
Yeah, I guess I feel the most important thing, you know, when you talk about the takeaway, what's the takeaway from your book?
Uh-huh.
I don't mean to sound negative, because I'm not negative, but you learn the transience of all things, and that is the toughest lesson of all. And once you can cope with that, then you can write what you wish. You can express yourself in a way that is conscious at every moment of that transience, yet refuses to yield to it.
James Atlas, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure.
James Atlas's new memoir is called My Life in the Middle Ages. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring the 2005 ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia from Sterling Publishing, a division of Barnes & Noble. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Aveda, working to save threatened and endangered plant species with beauty that cares for the earth, Earth Month, and every day. On the web at aveda.com. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Reza Aslan, author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. He describes the book as an argument for reform. Also, Rock Critic Ken Tucker reviews Mercy Now, the new album from singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Reza Aslan counts himself among the Muslims who want to reconcile their religious values with the realities of the modern world, as opposed to those who react to modernism and reform by reverting, sometimes fanatically, to the, quote, fundamentals of their faith. Aslan has written a new book called No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. He's taught Islamic and Middle Eastern studies at the University of Iowa, where he also received an MFA in fiction from the Writers Workshop. He studied religion at Santa Clara University, Harvard, and the University of California, Santa Barbara. He was born in Iran and fled the country as a child with his parents shortly after the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power. Many Americans consider Islam to be distant from Judaism and Christianity, but Aslan writes about the connections between the three religions.
Judaism, Christianity, and Islam share a single sacred history. They are, I call them, branches of the same Abrahamic tree. And Islam is firmly rooted in the values and myths and traditions of the Bible. In fact, almost every single biblical prophet is mentioned in the Quran, including Jesus. Most of the sort of the basic outline of the gospel narrative is recounted in the Quran. And Muhammad himself, this is something that I think is really interesting, never claimed to be preaching a new religion. On the contrary, I mean, he very clearly considered his prophetic mission to be to bring the God of the Jews and the Christians to the Arab peoples. There's a verse in the Quran that says, God has established for the Arabs the same religion that he enjoined on Noah and on Abraham and on Moses and on Jesus. So this is a continuation, as far as Muhammad was concerned, of that biblical prophetic tradition.
Did he consider the Jews and the Christians to have the same God?
Absolutely. There's no question about that whatsoever. He considered his mission to be to bring the God of the Jews and the Christians to the pagan Arab tribes of his community. In fact, the Jews and the Christians throughout the Quran are considered people of the book. And the Quran was specifically meant to bring a version of that book, an interpretation of that book, to the Arab people who did not have anything like that, who did not have anything resembling a revealed religion.
A lot of Westerners think of Islam as a culture that keeps women subservient and shrouded in a veil. You write that Muhammad gave rights and privileges to women that they never had before. What were some of those rights?
Muhammad was, more than anything else, a social reformer. He called for radical social and financial and even political reform in the Mecca that he grew up in and that he preached in. His community, the community that he established eventually, that became sort of the foundation of the Muslim community, that community gave certain egalitarian rights to all members, not just women, but also to orphans and widows and the poor and slaves who were all freed, the dispossessed. It was an egalitarian community. And with regard to women especially, I mean, Muhammad gave women the right to both inherit the property of their husbands, to keep their dowries as their own personal property throughout their marriage. He forbade a husband to touch his wife's dowry. He both limited how many wives a man could marry. In pre-Islamic Arabia, a man could marry as many wives as he wanted to. Wives were considered property. And he also gave women the right to divorce their husbands. Now, perhaps in our modern sensibilities, these seem like very small things, but the fact is that they were absolutely revolutionary at the time, and they caused an enormous amount of social disruption. And, you know, as I say in the book, that's primarily why, not long after Muhammad's death, most of these egalitarian reforms were gradually reversed.
Yeah, so why is it that it is Islam now that is the culture in which women are behind the veil? Mm-hmm. And why is it that so many Muslim leaders turn to their faith to explain and justify that?
Right. Well, I think, first of all, I need to say that the Quran, like all holy scriptures, was deeply affected by the cultural norms of the society in which it was revealed. I mean, this was a society that did not consider women to be equal members of the tribe. And so as a result, there are numerous verses in the Quran that, along with the Jewish and Christian scriptures, clearly reflect the subordinate position that women had in the male-dominated societies of the ancient world. However, a lot of what we now sort of see as these emblems of Islamic subjugation of women, and the veil in particular, are more the result of cultural and local practices. I'll give you a perfect example. The veil, I think, is a great example. I think it would come as a surprise for a lot of people to learn that nowhere in the whole of the Quran is the veil in any way enjoined on women, except for the wives of Muhammad himself. The veil was a cultural practice that Muslims borrowed from the upper-class women in Syria and Iran. And it was a way of sort of separating those women within the Muslim community who were separate, who were distinct from the rest of the women. And it's precisely for this reason that during Muhammad's lifetime, no other woman in the Muslim community except for Muhammad's wives took on the veil. It was only after Muhammad's death that women started to voluntarily adopt wearing the veil as a means of emulating the prophet's wives.
Making it sound that like a lot of women first took on the veil because it's what the celebrities did, you know, like the wives of Muhammad. Well, do you know what I mean? It was like a status, correct. Like it was a status symbol.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to remember that at this day and age, a woman who didn't have to work in the fields could remain veiled and secluded from the rest of the community. And so it was absolutely a sign of social status and a sign of the inviolability. And, you know, it came to be seen as a distinctive emblem. I get asked this question about the veil a lot, and I can sit here and tell you what the correct interpretation of the Quran is and what the Quran actually says about the veil and what the historical practice of the veil was and what the meaning of the veil was. But the problem is that I'm speaking from a position of a man who's never worn the veil. This is what I think is so important about this discussion, is that it is up to Muslim women to decide for themselves whether they want to wear the veil or not. It is not up to Muslim men to decide. It is not up to scholars like myself to decide. And it is not up to governments to decide. This is a choice that women must be allowed to make themselves.
I understand what you mean. I would just ask you this. What about the fact that there are some women who live in remote places who are only told that they should wear the veil, that yes. It's a part of the faith that they wear the veil. They don't know that there are other options. They've never heard another interpretation of it. So, you know, if you only hear one thing and that one thing mandates the veil and tells you that it's a good thing for whatever reasons, then it would be more difficult for you to either come up with another interpretation or feel justified in believing it.
You're absolutely right. And of course, the key to freedom, the key to liberty is always education. It's always knowledge. And that's what my hope is with this book. And I think that there are a number of people like myself throughout the Muslim world who are desperately struggling to provide an ideological counter argument, an ideological counterweight to these traditionalists, one can say fundamentalist viewpoints that permeate throughout the Muslim world.
My guest is Reza Aslan, author of the new book, No God But God. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Reza Aslan, author of the new book, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. You were born in Iran and lived there for the first 7 years of your life. How religious was your home? Like, what was your parents' approach in bringing you up in an Islamic home?
You know, Iranians are no different than peoples of most countries. You know, if you're born in Iran, you're pretty much a Muslim, just like a great number of Americans just sort of naturally call themselves Christian. It's not any more or less religious. In fact, I would argue that it's less religious than the United States. So I grew up in your basic average Muslim family. You know, we went to mosque occasionally and you know, we celebrated the Muslim holidays and we celebrated the Iranian national holidays. My mom was a spiritual person. My father is, well, I could most politely refer to him as anti-religious. He is someone who really sees and has an enormous amount of bitterness, as a great many Iranians in the United States do, over what has happened to Iran and the clerical control that has really stifled the freedom and the independence and the reform that was taking place in Iran. He really blames Islam for that rather than the clerics themselves. And I think a lot of people agree with him.
What were your parents? You were very young. So what were your parents' expectations when the Shah was overthrown and Khomeini came to power?
Well, I think most everyone in Iran thought that this was going to be a wonderful thing. Only after the Shah left and only after the revolution sort of was completed, came to fruition, did Iran then become the Islamic republic that it is now. But for most of us, I mean, this was an opportunity to get those freedoms and those liberties that we were fighting for in the first place, that we were promised throughout the revolution in the first place. And there's been an enormous amount of disappointment by the very same people who led this revolution, who are now feeling as though that their original intentions had been betrayed.
So what was the turning point for your parents at which they realized that this wasn't going to be a democratizing revolution, that one form of tyranny, the Shah, was going to be replaced with another form of tyranny, the Ayatollah?
It was the creation of the Constitution. When the Constitution was drafted and it became very clear that this Constitution was going to lead the way towards the clerical domination of the country, that's when my father realized it's time to leave. And we got out of Iran at the last minute, right before the country closed.
How did your parents explain to you that you were going to flee the country?
Well, as far as I remember it, they just woke me up one morning and said, "Get your stuff." That's really how I remember it. It was a spur of the moment decision. I think we were in a rush to get out before the borders were sealed, and we just sort of got on the first flight out. We left most of our possessions behind, and ended up, as so many Iranians did, in London, and then from London came to the United States.
When your parents said, "Get your stuff," what did you take?
Well, I mean, we were each allowed one suitcase. But then by the time we got to the airport and we saw the millions and millions of other people trying to get out and the absolute chaos that was taking place at customs, we knew that it would be a miracle even if we could take that one suitcase along. In fact, most of our valuables had to be left behind with the customs agents, who basically opened our suitcase and found the things that they wanted and said, "You can't take this," and pocketed it themselves.
You describe in your book that your mother at the airport hollered at you, "Hold on to your sister." And she was afraid in this crush of people that if you let go of your sister, you might not all make it together. You might not get
That's
on
right.
the plane together. What a really frightening thing for a 7-year-old to have to deal with. What was that moment like for you when you realized you had to hold on tight?
It was like a dream. The entire thing was really like a dream. I mean, I just remember grasping onto my sister and kicking at the people in front of me and knocking people to the ground as a 7-year-old boy dragging his 4-year-old sister behind him, making sure that I never lost sight of my mother. But I really did feel, I really did have the sense that if something happened, if I let go of my sister or if I lost sight of my mother, that would be the end of it, that we would be separated forever.
So you went first to London, and then how soon after that did you move to the U.S.?
Quite soon after that, about a few months afterwards, we moved to the U.S. We moved to Oklahoma, which is the only place my father had ever been in the United States. I think it's what he thought the United States was. We went to Enid, Oklahoma. And
it seems like
father,
a very improbable place.
It is. It's as you can imagine, first time I'd ever seen snow. I was really confused. And during that first year, we really didn't have anything with us, so we had to live in a one-room motel. And, of course, my father told the management that he had no kids, so my sister and I were never allowed to actually leave the hotel during the daylight hours. So we just sat in a hotel and watched TV for, 24 hours a day for about a year. And at the end of the year, both of us were absolutely fluent in English. So it ended up working okay.
Well, you know, your parents basically had to flee Iran because of the tyranny there. So successful. The family gets out in one piece, all intact. And what luck, you move to Oklahoma, and now you're not allowed to leave the motel room, and no one's allowed to know that you're there. So basically you're a prisoner in a cheap hotel room. And right. It's not exactly fleeing to freedom for you during that first year.
No, it's not. And it was an incredibly difficult time for my family and caused an enormous amount of tension. You know, for a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, you figure out a way to have your own fun. And quite frankly, seeing television for the like this, I mean, we had TV in Iran, but not 24 hours and not 30 channels and not Chips and Sesame Street. And, you know, for a while, I mean, this is how I learned about not just how to speak English, but about American culture is watching, you know, Ponch and John riding down the L.A. freeways and blowing up cars for no reason. I thought for a long time, I thought cars just all the time flipped over as they were driving around freeways. I thought that was a perfectly normal thing for them to do in America.
What kind of work did your parents do in Iran?
Well, they really didn't work. You know, I sometimes like to say that it's the people like my parents that the revolution was originally intended against. My father comes from a very large landed aristocracy, a landed old tribal family. And my mother is the child of entertainers, my grandfather Jahangir and my grandmother Giti were both quite famous stage and television actors in Iran. So my mom came from this liberal, modern Iranian, sort of the new Iran, and my father came from the ancient tribal old Iran. So it was really a clash of civilizations right there that gave birth to me.
The United States and Europe has been trying to figure out what its policy should be now toward Iran and Iran's move toward being a nuclear power. So can you talk a little bit about watching that play out?
Right. Well, I've been writing and lecturing and teaching about the U.S. taking a far more active role in engaging Iran in the nuclear diplomacy, the way that the Europeans have for I don't know how long now, for years. And I'm really glad that the Bush administration has finally decided to do so, to take a more active part in negotiations. I mean, the fact is that we cannot allow this particular regime in Iran to become a nuclear weapons regime. I think that there's very little indication that they would do so, but you know, it's really hard to trust what this regime says, whether they truly want to have these nuclear weapons and whether it's just for civilian purposes, as they say. But I think it's important that the world body recognizes that Iran is not a hermit kingdom like North Korea. It is not a oppressive theocracy like Saudi Arabia is. It is quite an open society, and it is a society that can be engaged in negotiation. It is a society that can be engaged in dialogue, and it is a society that has the vast majority of its population who desperately wants the country to be opened, to be more open to the West economically, socially. And the only way to do so is through negotiations, not through sanctions, and certainly not through isolations. That hasn't worked.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was absolutely my pleasure.
Reza Aslan is the author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by singer and songwriter Mary Gaucher. This is Fresh Air. Mary Gaucher is from Louisiana and writes country-influenced autobiographical songs that she usually performs in concerts accompanied by just her own guitar. Her new album, Mercy Now, finds her working with Austin, Texas-based producer-performer Gerf Morlix. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
My father could use a little mercy now. The fruits of his labor falling right slowly on the ground. His work is almost over.
That's the title song for Mary Gaucher's new album, and if you read any interviews with her, you'll quickly discover that the father she's singing about in that composition is her adoptive father, now stricken with Alzheimer's. As always with material taken from real life, the question is how to transmute private pain into art without exploiting the lives you claim to be bestowing mercy upon. Gaucher cuts closer to the bone than most, yet she also manages to avoid the pity or self-absorption that such a style encourages. The most emblematic of the confessions that characterizes her work is an already widely admired song called I Drink.
He'd get home at 5:30, fix his drink, sit down in his chair, pick a fight with mama, complain about us kids getting in his hair. At night he'd sit alone and smoke. I'd see his frown behind his lighter's flame. Now that same frown's in my mirror. I got my daddy's blood inside my veins. Fish swim, birds fly, daddy's yell, mama's cry, old men sit and think. I drink.
While Gaucher has said that she was picturing a man in a room thinking those thoughts when she wrote I Drink, she's also made no bones about the fact that she's a recovering alcoholic. What's most striking about the song is the utter simplicity of the chorus, with its seven lines of two- and three-syllable words. When you hear her southern twang make something tart and matter-of-fact out of the words, I drink, you know it's something else, a number of things, a confession, a memory, a regret, a boast, an endless source of wonderment, pain, and pleasure, all crammed into the blunt declaration, I drink. Elsewhere, Gaucher could use more bluntness.
The parade of souls is marching across the sky. Their heat and their light bathed in blue as they march by. The all-stars play when the saints go marching in. Second line forms, and they wave white hankies in the wind. Satchmo takes a solo, he flashes his million-dollar smile.
Sometimes Mary Gaucher goes in the opposite direction of I Drink's minimalism, over-decorating a song like that one, Wheel Inside the Wheel, cramming too many, too colorful images into her lines. The stuff about Satchmo smiling and Marie Laveau prancing with Oscar Wilde is show-offy stuff that's redeemed only by the more artful chorus about the efficacy of the soul. But no matter which mode she's in, Gaucher's music is helped enormously by producer Gerf Morlix, whose own astringent albums I've reviewed here in the past.
It's a cheap hotel. The heat pipes hiss. The bathroom's down the hall and it smells like piss. It's another night in another town. And I'm another blues track. Calling out love is a dangerous thing, with its slippery slopes and its weighted wings, with its birds of prey circling overhead, casting vulture shadows on barren beds. Let me out.
Gerf Morlix knows that music like this can benefit enormously from a rhythm section, bass and drums that move pokey guitar lines along briskly, and backup vocals that emphasize the catchiness of a chorus. Too often, singer-songwriters in Gaucher's style reject these touches as commercial. Lucinda Williams' entire career is one long battle with such decisions, for example. But Gaucher's album sounds all the better for her giving herself over to Morlix's musical suggestions. It would be facile to say that she, unlike Lucinda, has learned that a certain amount of humility, of giving up control, is one way to regain complete control. So instead, I'll say that Mary Gaucher's Mercy Now offers an admirable model for singer-songwriter music, doling out autobiography while dispensing with ego, using the music to enrich, not exploit, a life.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed Mercy Now by Mary Gaucher. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
There's a big storm coming. Of this I've no doubt. That storm's gonna blow.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Bantam, publisher of The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud, a novel about the enduring power of love by Ben Sherwood, author of The Man Who Ate the 747, from Capella University, offering degrees online in education, business, technology, psychology, and human services at 1-888-CAPELLA. And from the David Bruce Smith Family Foundation, supporting humanitarian causes. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with writer and director Rebecca Miller about her new movie, The Ballad of Jack and Rose, starring her husband, Daniel Day-Lewis. She's also writing a screenplay based on a play by her late father, Arthur Miller. Her previous film, Personal Velocity, won an Independent Spirit Award and a Sundance Award. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.